Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, welcome, welcome, welcome. So today is Pi Day, and not like the kind of pie that we get to eat. This is not taste and see that the Lord is good kind of Pi Day. This is Pi Day as in pi, the mathematical constant, 3.14, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Today is also National Walkout Day for schools. And so I definitely, later in the program, I would love to hear from you about how that's going in your own communities. Did your kids walk out of school today? Are you a student who walked out today? Is that something that is yet to happen where you live? Because I do know that for some schools and groups, this is actually something that's sort of like a rolling over time, depending on the time zone that you live in. These 17-minute protests, which were to begin at 10 a.m. And started then, but certainly are still happening and are not confined to school campuses. And in some cases, kids never even showed up for school. So we are talking about, well, the numbers, I'm sure they're going to estimate them tomorrow. But in the pictures that we're seeing on social media and the videos that we're seeing on the news, you know, it's thousands and thousands of students in cities all across the country. 3,000 school districts were informed in advance that there were organized walkouts planned for their communities. That number is now has already risen higher than that in terms of places where it's actually taken place. Different school districts responding very differently to the planned walkouts. And you say to yourself, oh, my goodness, I don't even know about this. I don't know what's going on. Well, this is the one month anniversary of the shootings, the massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And so the 17 people who lost their lives today, that's why the protests were initially intended to be 17 minutes long, a 17-minute walk out of class at 10 a.m. Eastern to mark a point in time. And what you are hearing these students say is basically, you know, no more gun violence. Like, you know, time is up on gun violence. And so how do we move forward from that? You and I both know that the kind of change these students are seeking takes a long time, that this process is something that is legislative and isn't going to happen overnight. It'll be interesting to see how patient these students are. You and I remember being young, and sometimes when you're young, you don't recognize the process that is required for some things to change. And so I understand that they feel like there's just no time left for these things to happen. So we'll be interested in hearing from you what your experiences of the walkout have been, and your experiences in your own family in terms of conversations related to these things, school safety, gun violence, certainly the access that young people have, not only to guns, but I mean, you know, let's just recognize that, you know, almost anything can become a deadly weapon in the hand of a person who seeks to do harm to others. You know, it only took, you know, Cain access to a rock in the first generation to slay his brother Abel. And so we recognize that what we're dealing with is a darkness in the heart of man. And we also recognize a desperate need in our culture in relationship to family brokenness and in relationship to getting kids the help that they need, particularly when their family systems are broken and mental health issues are an issue. So this is a multi-layered, multifaceted, complex situation in Parkland, Florida, with this one individual student. But it has blossomed into a nationwide conversation, not only about access to guns, but a conversation about education and school safety. And so I want to have those conversations with those of you interested in doing so. We will actually probably do that in the last few minutes of the show today, but want to let you know in advance that I'm looking forward to having those conversations and taking your calls. And the number here is 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. Here's what we're doing here. We're trying to take the headlines of the day. We're trying to bring the Christian worldview to bear, preparing you to actually faithfully enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. And so the headlines today not only include this national school walkout from Maine to Hawaii, but also the death of Stephen Hawking. And so I want to talk about that for a moment. Stephen Hawking may be the most recognized and recognizable name of any scientist, maybe, I don't know, since Einstein. You pick a scientist whose name is as familiar not only to people in the scientific community, but all the way, you know, to children. Stephen Hawking had an ability to communicate his ideas as frankly as vacant as those ultimately were in terms of a theistic worldview. But he had an ability to communicate from a very broken body and through a literally robotic voice. He had the ability to communicate ideas about the cosmos and the universe that literally captivated generations of people. And so when we talk about the death of Stephen Hawking, for those of you who are not familiar with him, he is an iconic English theoretical physicist. He made his life's work the exploration of the cosmos and trying to explain the universe in scientific terms, with reference to the reality of God. His contributions to the study of the universe would include things like, you know, the origin of the cosmos, like where everything came from. And he argued that everything came from nothing, which, frankly, is not plausible. And then he did plumb the mysteries of the nature of black holes, which he then ultimately had to acknowledge, is a mystery beyond what science can actually describe. But there are mysteries that revelation enables us to describe. And so today is actually a great day for Christians to enter into the kinds of conversations that even scientifically minded people are open to having. Where did it all come from? Where is it all going? And what happens when we die? Right? Stephen Hawking is a person whose body failed him very early on, diagnosed at the age of 21 with what we call Lou Gehrig's disease. I think miraculously lived with that disease for more than 50 years and was able, because of science and technology and frankly wealth, extraordinary wealth, to live as long as he lived. And in 1988 published a book that sold more than 10 million copies entitled A Brief History of Time, From the Big Bang to Black Holes. And so the reason that we talk about Stephen Hawking is because everybody is talking about Stephen Hawking today. And so this is a household name that you and I should be able to enter into a conversation about today. And so what is the reality of life and death in time and space? And Hawking was a person who explored whether or not time travel was possible. He liked to imagine that it was. He did an experiment once. This is maybe one of my favorite stories that I have read today about him. He planned a big party. He printed the invitations, and then he didn't send them out. He held the party, and he was testing his theory that time travel was possible by not sending out the invitations until after the event was over. And in hindsight, then he said, well, in fact, I just sat there by myself for a really long time. So he is an interesting fellow. He used humor a lot to make his point, and he never dismissed a question from a child. I think that's actually something that is profoundly important for you and I to recognize. He never dismissed anyone's questions. Now, his view of the cosmos included no room for God. And yet he himself acknowledged that there were mysteries beyond what science could explain. And so today, don't dismiss the questions of those who may reject God simply because they've never met a person like you who was in a position to introduce them to God. And maybe here's the lesson of today when we talk about people like Stephen Hawking and people who come from a purely scientism worldview, who view the world exclusively through the lens of science. You can reject God in this life, but in the life to come, each and every one of us is going to come face to face with God's holiness. And we will be subjected to the reality of God's ultimate and eternal sovereignty. That day is coming. The Bible makes clear that the day will come when every knee will bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And so even the knees of Stephen Hawking will one day bow to Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. And that that is something that is at the heart of evangelical faith. And that is the message that you and I can joyfully, invitationally share with other people. Today, in light of the fact that Stephen Hawking has died, in light of these walkouts that are happening across the country, death is real. It comes for all of us. And you and I actually know the God who is sovereign, not only on this side of it, but on the other side as well. So it would simply give you an opportunity to consider today the reality of death, the reality of what's going to happen after we die, the reality of the cosmos. Spend some time thinking about the cosmological reality of the gospel. This is a gospel universe, and God is sovereign in all of it. All right, friends, we got to take a quick break. But when I come back, we're going to be having a conversation you will not want to miss. My guest is Scott Lamb. He's a vice president of Liberty University. He's the co-author of The Faith of Donald J. Trump, a spiritual biography of our president. Hey, friends, don't miss it. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, and we'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBerge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. You can follow me on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. And if you have questions about the conversation I'm about to have with Scott Lamb, you can always email me. I am Carmen at faithradio.com. All right, so my conversation partner this afternoon is Scott Lamb. He is a Baptist minister. He's a columnist for the Washington Times. He's a vice president of Liberty University. He has authored three other biographies, including Pujols, which is about Albert Pujols, and it's a great book about baseball. Huckabee, which you will recognize as an authorized biography of a candidate for president who didn't become president, and then this biography about the president of the United States, The Faith of Donald J. Trump, a spiritual biography co-authored by Scott Lamb and David Brody. Scott, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thanks for having me. Congratulations on the new show. It sounds great, and I am thrilled to be on this on the program today to talk about this new book.
Well, you are an evangelical Christian, so I am just going to start with the hardest question that I have, and that is, what did you learn? What did you learn about the faith of the president as you researched and wrote this book?
Yeah, well, that's what everybody wants to know. And here's the thing: the title is the title of any book, as well as the cover, is what sells a book. So publishers don't allow you to write a three-sentence title that, you know, really gives a lot of nuance. If we'd written a three-sentence title, we would have said something like the worldview and philosophical background and maybe the church history background of the Trump family in general, with specific notation about this other guy named Donald, who's now our president. Yeah, the fact of the matter is, though, marketing just grabbed a title like The Faith of Donald Trump, and we said, hey, a year ago, we said, hey, you know, that's going to be pretty provocative because, you know, the faith of, you know, designate, it sounds like you're saying, you know, well, this man has an evangelical faith. I know a lot of our evangelical brothers and sisters are going to stumble over that title. We went with it. We went with it. And here's why. There's a large pedigree. There's a large ancestry of books exactly like this with even the same title. I've got on my shelf The Faith of Ronald Reagan, The Faith of Barack Obama, The Faith of George W. Bush. There was one written in The Faith of Hillary Clinton, came out in 2008. And so there's a pedigree here, and, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel with titles. Now, with Trump, it's just explosively provocative to talk about the faith of in the context of somebody who has lived his life in hedonistic terms as a playboy. And so it has. It has been provocative both from the left and from the right. We've caught it from both ways. But I think we give the reader a lot to think of. The key word there is the reader. You have to actually read the book, which means you have to get past the title and read the book. And I know that you have, I believe. So I'm looking forward to talking about that, about what's actually on the inside of the book, not just on the cover. So
that's exactly right.
What else do you got in mind there?
Yeah, so I have read the book. And one of the things, because I know you personally, one of the things that I really appreciated was how often I could actually hear your voice on the pages of this book. I felt like you were using the opportunity of talking about faith and talking about the faith, that would actually be a provocative conversation in the culture, and that you used it as an opportunity to talk about the faith. I could see your intentional effort to actually introduce the reader to the truth, to the faith. So am I seeing more than is there, or did I kind of get what some people probably missed?
Yeah. Well, everybody wants to know, when we're writing the book, everybody wants to know the $10,000 question, is Trump a Christian? And within that evangelical context, I mean, is he born again? Is he regenerate? Is he headed for heaven? Is his name written in the Lamb's Book of Life? And we actually say right in the introduction, we're not answering that question. We both have an opinion on that subject. It's a co-authored book. We have an opinion on that subject. Our opinions probably aren't exactly aligned, as co-authors, but we had an understanding going into the book that we were going to let other people that were willing to speak on that subject do the speaking, and we weren't going to actually, say, well, as the authors, we believe, we can look into a soul and say yay or nay. So we avoided that. We let a lot of other people do the talking, including, from Vice President Mike Pence all the way down to people who've known him in the last few years, evangelical preachers. A lot of people were willing to speak on that and to speculate on that. So we put that in the book. We avoided answering that question ourselves, but what we wanted to do was just set up the historical context of his worldview. We use that word a lot. I know on your program you guys have, like John Stone Street, that's a very familiar word. Now within evangelical circles, the worldview, how is a person's mind, how do they think about the world, about God? And a hedonist is not a secularist. So a secularist, has an understanding that, there really isn't a divine source, and there's nothing really controlling the world. Maybe like you were speaking about Stephen Hawking, that might have been more of his worldview. But Donald Trump is not a secularist, not in the least. A hedonist, yes. A playboy, yes. He's lived his life very much in front of the camera for the tabloids as a hedonist. But that is not the same thing as somebody who has lived their lives mentally apart from a construct that there is a God, there is an eternity. It's not really shaped by biblical foundations and formulations, as we talk about in the book. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that he was born into a family that was attending a mainline church, which, as a matter of historical record, had watered down just nearly all of the teaching of their historic Presbyterian church, moving away from the Westminster, standards to basically just saying, if you can say the words, Jesus is Lord, well, that's good enough for us. That's all it takes. You're one of the chosen. And, that was pretty much it. And so he came of age in a mainline culture that really de-emphasized doctrine. Of course, the same can be said in many evangelical churches, but he wasn't part of those, so we didn't, bring that into the picture.
Exactly.
But he was part of the mainline, which had lost a lot of historic orthodoxy. And then what's funny during the election is all the mainliners who lined up to say, this guy doesn't know scripture, this guy doesn't know doctrine. It's like, right, in other words, he's very much like you have positioned your denominations to be. And now you're complaining that he doesn't know much about the Bible, So again,
well,
there's a fault that we can be laid at evangelical churches as well, but a similar critique, and we made some of that as well in the book. But
yeah, so yesterday I actually heard him say Frozen Chosen in relationship to something totally other than Presbyterianism.
Really?
Or mainline Christianity. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I don't even – like. He doesn't even – I don't think he knows what it means. I don't think he knows what it refers to. And I'm thinking to myself, he just used a phrase that actually does mean something to some people in some context. And
That's
he used
right.
it completely out of context and in relationship to something totally different.
That's hilarious.
I mean, I just thought to myself, okay, even self-referentially, he kind of misses it sometimes.
I think so. I think you're right. You know, there's something to be said about, okay, so his mother was raised on a tiny island off the coast of Scotland, as part of the Scotland, Scottish nation. And they were so staunchly Presbyterian that it wasn't until a few years ago, like maybe 5 years ago, that they even allowed the ferry, that, you know, the only means of transportation to and from the mainland. It was only a few years ago that they broke with their Sabbatarian practices to allow the ferry to run. So, I mean, she left there in the 30s when like just Westminster confession driven Presbyterianism ruled the day. Now, I'm not saying she you know, brought all that and kept it all, but you know, we are made of what we was what was put into us as children and youth, and you know, so they memorized the catechism in the Gaelic version of the Westminster, and she landed in Manhattan, became, you know, met Fred, had you know, all these children, and her life is really a fascinating account of, you know, the immigrant that comes, brings over their religion, whether that was passed down directly to Trump in a regeneration sort of way. I don't think so. But what was passed down was a very high regard for the Bible and for things of God. And, you know, it wasn't as strong as what it would have been if she'd stayed in Scotland. Probably not. You know, we tend to get caught up in what we're part of in our lives. And she might have drifted from her staunchness of her youth, but she definitely carried something. And so we talk about the Presbyterianism of Donald Trump for four chapters. We talk about his father's Lutheran background and the worldview that he had, which basically, in a nutshell, really grabbed on to the work ethic of Lutheran Protestantism. I don't know that it grabbed onto much else of Martin Luther, but he definitely was a man that was firmly stamped with the work ethic of his first-generation immigrant mother, you know, Fred. Just an incredible American. And so roughly 20% of the book is talking about his Donald Trump's parents.
And, I know. And that was actually, I mean, I'll just say that, you know, as a person who comes out of the main line, I thoroughly appreciated that approach, and that you laid the foundation of, okay, whether or not you think this person has an active faith in the way that you would describe it today, this is a person who foundationally grew up culturally Christian here in the United States of America.
Yes.
During the heyday of mainline Christianity. And so if we're going to set criticism at the feet of any institutional church at this point, where we would be setting that criticism is to say, okay, now look, we had mainline Presbyterianism and mainline Lutheranism, both with a really good chance to raise this person up, to influence this person. And so if you've got criticisms of him in terms of his understanding of the faith or the way that the faith is in practice, maybe in his language or even in his policies, then that's really where you're going to have to look. And you're going to have to say, how did mainline Presbyterianism, mainline Lutheranism lose this person along the way, if he is not who you think he should be in terms of your particular version or variety of Christianity? Hey, Scott, we're going to have to go to a hard break here in just a second. But I want to let folks know the book we're talking about is The Faith of Donald J. Trump, a spiritual biography. Scott Lamb is one of the co-authors of this book. It is long. It is meaty. It is a feast. And it does explore what it looks like for a person to live maybe on the first generation shadow of the real faith of our parents and grandparents. So my conversation partner is Scott Lamb. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we will be right back. Hey friends, welcome back. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is Connecting Faith. You can find me on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. You can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. And later in the hour, I'm going to actually be taking your calls. So if you don't already have the phone number plugged into your speed dial, now's the time to put it there. It's 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And in a few minutes, I'm going to be taking your calls not only about this conversation that I'm currently having with Scott Lamb about the faith of the president, but also I would love to hear your feedback about what's happening out there in terms of this national walkout taking place across the country, high school and junior high students walking out of their classrooms in support of change, substantive change in the culture related to gun violence and school safety. All right, friends, my conversation partner is Scott Lamb. He has co-authored a spiritual biography about Donald Trump. So it's called The Faith of Donald J. Trump. It's by David Brody and Scott Lamb. And Scott Lamb is here with me today. Welcome, my friend.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so you have, this book's been out for about a month. Actually, I think a month today. And you have had some opportunity to have some feedback. Maybe I'll say it that way.
Lots of feedback.
Lots of feedback. Man, anybody that follows you on social media, I mean, we have been like, you know, praying for you from afar because we don't want to jump into that fray, man. So tell us what the feedback has been on the book from both the left and the right.
Yeah, so both from the left and the right, well, we've got a lot of good feedback, but let's not talk about that. That's boring. You know, a lot of people enjoy the book, and they've written in to tell us that, and it's, you know, a great book. And those tend to be people who, you know, whatever their misgivings they had about voting for Trump or whatever misgivings they might have about his presidency or no misgivings, they enjoy the book. They've got, you know, an open mind to read things about that. But let's just go on the criticism, the hard criticism, which when you write a book, it's going to get criticism. So you're ready for that. First of all, there's the category of people who literally have not read it, and they don't even mind it saying that. They say, "This, I'm not going to take the time to read this. This is stupid." We had a columnist that wrote for the LA Times that pretty much said, "I haven't read it, and I advise you not to read it either." Well, it's like, wow, that's a really open-minded perspective. But he said, you know, Brody and Lamb are probably going to burn in hell for writing a book like this, and maybe God will be gracious enough to send down a case of their book so they'll have something to read while they're in eternity. I don't know that he actually, you know, believes in hell, but, you know, Brody and I have kind of joked that it seems like we've gotten a resurgence and revival can be laid at our feet here, because there's so many people who are basically secularists who say that we're going to burn in hell. So anyway, a lot of people say that, you know, we're amazed that the book, they said, well, it's probably a book full of blank pages. I mean, what could you write about? Or it's going to be the world's shortest book, you know, The Faith of Donald Trump. What is it, 2 pages long? Seth Meyers said that, you know, it could probably be printed on a Chiclet. And, you know, so on the other side, when the people actually get it and they find out it's 300 pages, it's, you know, 40 pages of footnotes, almost 500 footnotes, then they go in the other extreme. There was a guy, the radio guy down from Georgia, he wrote a big review, and he said, oh, it's just full of fluff. You know, it's 300 pages, but it's full of fluff. Well, I mean, you know, which way are you going to go? You're going to say it's the world's shortest book, or are you going to say it's 300 pages, but it's full of fluff? I mean, you know, at any rate. Then there's the group that we basically say, and they'll admit, you know, I was never Trump. They'll say, I couldn't vote for him, and I'm pretty much against him now. I'm an evangelical. I'm against him now. And to be honest, you can't write a book that is – no book is going to be any good. A book is not going to be good if you try to be all things to all people. So have we read all the Never Trump pieces in the last 3 years? Yeah, actually, any leading Never Trump voice that's out there, we have thoroughly gone through their works and considered their arguments against him as a candidate, now as a president. But you can't write a book trying hard to please everybody. It just doesn't work. So then there's that other large group, and part of them are Never Trumpers, and part of them are just the people that are out there that say, hey, you know, you're selling your soul. The evangelicals who are in the White House talking to the president, you've sold your soul. You have a lust for political power, for political access. And I just want to say, listen, guys, I have no political power. I have no access. I'm an author. I'm a vice president of Liberty, which basically, I mean, my position, I'm helping faculty members write books, you know, figure out how to write books and get published. I have no political power. I'm an author. This is a historical biographical work. My co-author is a broadcast journalist. So perhaps it is possible to sell your soul to have political access. Yeah, I get it, but that cuts both ways. You know, there were a lot of people lining up to get into Obama's Oval Office as well, and, you know, even on the evangelical side. And so here's what it comes down to, Carmen. We found that both sides of the what do you think about Donald Trump's soul, they're both saying the same thing, pointing a big finger at each other and saying the same thing. And we call them the law guys, the guys who are on the side of law and holiness, which is one part of the gospel. And then there's guys on the other side, which will say, well, they're on the grace side. Now, I know neither side's going to say that they're going to agree with us on that assessment. Both sides claim that they're both. But there's some on the one side who are saying, if all pastors were like you, then the Donald Trumps of the world would never be able to get saved because they're never going to hear about God's holiness. And then on the other side, there's, we hear, if all pastors were like you guys, the Donald Trumps of the world would never get saved because they're never going to hear about grace. And we're catching it on both sides because we're like, hey, dude, there's a lot of things about Donald Trump's life that you know, all 10 commandments have been broken, okay? You know, and we put that in the book. So there's definitely, you know, law breaking. But we also like to say, yes, but he's still alive. He's still breathing. You know, he's still got a heart that's beating. And in the last 2 years alone, evangelical gospel preachers who never get their name in the paper because they do not want to have their name in the paper. They don't tweet about their access to the president. They're in there and they're talking to the president, or before that they were talking to the candidate about the gospel, about the law and the grace. And they're doing this, and there's no social media presence. They're not, you know, trying to get selfies with the president. It's just they're gospel preachers. They've been gospel preachers for 40 or 50 years. Now, I'm not saying that none of the preachers are you know, avoiding the selfies. A lot of them are. But I'm just saying there's a private conversation that is going on. What is the condition of his soul? I'm not here to say what that is. But all I'm saying is it is not true that evangelicals are not giving him law. It is true that some evangelicals are not offering grace. And I just, to that crowd, I'd like to say, soften your heart. Soften your heart a little bit. The older brother needed to soften his heart and realize that he was not actually friends with the father in the parable of the prodigal son. The younger brother needed to get rid of the prostitutes and get out of the pig pen and come home. If there's one brother that best summarizes Donald Trump, it's not the older brother, okay? He's never been an older brother. He's never been a law-keeping, law-abiding brother. From his earliest days, he's been a prodigal son from the law of God, okay? Some would say, when I use this parable, would say, oh, but he's still in the pig pen. Really? Who are you to know exactly where the man's heart is right now? Well, 5 years ago. Well, 10 years. Yeah, right. Well, maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, he was that, you know. But where are you to say, how are you to say he is absolutely still in the pig pen of immoralities right now? Okay, now, if he comes out tomorrow and he says, hey, I love hedonism still. All right, I got no problem saying, you know, if he's going to testify to the world that he loves hedonistic ways, then clearly he still is in an unrepentant state. All I'm saying is soften your heart to the idea that God's grace saves younger brothers. And if you can't soften your heart that way, then just ask yourself, to what extent am I like basically acting like the older brother? And in my understanding of the parable, both brothers needed salvation. At the end of the parable, mm-hmm. Jesus said he was talking to the Pharisees. He used that parable to talk to the Pharisees. And in real life, the Pharisees crucified Jesus. They didn't repent. So both sides need repentance. It's just that from my experience as a pastor, it's the guy who's drunk every weekend who sometimes is just a little bit softer in his heart towards understanding his need for repentance, as opposed to the person who's been in church his entire life but still is apart from grace.
Hmm. Hey, friends, the voice you're hearing is Scott Lamb. He is the co-author of The Faith of Donald J. Trump, A Spiritual Biography. Scott, I was reminded of a few things while you were sharing there, and one of those was just how much of Billy Graham's preaching I've listened to in the last few weeks, and one of the things that I heard in listening this time around that I don't think I heard when I was listening more sporadically, you know, sort of like over the course of time, if you listen to the things that he said back to back to back. One of the astonishing things that came through was how often he addresses the church-going people who are in the crowd, who really, over the course of time, having heard the gospel and heard the gospel and heard the gospel, are simply hardened to it.
Yes.
And so they're there. They are the people who have funded the crusade. They are the people who, are making the gospel presentation possible to people who they regard as lost, failing to see then their own need for for the gospel and for redemption and for substantially restored relationships, not only with God, but, you know, but with one another. And so I feel that coming through a little bit in the conversation that we're having now, and the need for each of us and all of us, regardless of how long we've been in the church and how long we've been, you know, counted among the faithful, that we have to recognize that culturally we have a desperate need for the gospel to be presented through each of us to all of us. And that's part of what I hear you saying.
It is. Morality does not keep you from a need for grace. And immorality cannot block your access to grace. We all come through the foot of the cross. And for some, the lives of sin are internal, religious, piety. And you'll never see what those inner rotten bones are, because it's just internal things. And others, they've lived it in the tabloids. They've bragged about it to, you know, TV programs about what they do and don't do. And so their immoralities are there. And if the moralist without Christ and the immoral person without Christ, they both have the same eternal fate. So, you know, I just say come to Christ, and that's kind of hopefully what drips throughout the book. Because we, ultimately, my co-author and I know that we're going to stand before the face of Jesus one day and give an account for our entire life, and we're going to be under the grace of God because of our confession of Him, our repentance and faith in Him. But as far as what we've done in life with our with the talents we've been given, this book was couched in the prayer that when we see Jesus face to face, we would not be ashamed, not ashamed at all of what we've written and how we wrote it, and maybe the fruit. So,
I appreciate that. So we're looking forward to what you're doing next as well. So excited for what you're doing at Liberty. Linda Mentor is one of our colleagues here at Faith Radio, and then Karen Swallow Pryor is going to be on with me on Friday. So
fantastic.
Appreciate the folks at Liberty and everything that you guys are doing to equip the next generation of Christians to really live authentically across every vocation. And I certainly appreciate how you do that as an author and spiritual biographer. So let me ask you a walk-off question just about that. So as a spiritual biographer, I'm just interested to know, like, how do you resist the temptation to sort of write what you wish were true of a person?
Instead of writing, what you wish was true, I think it's even easier when you pick somebody that it's a little controversial. I mean, you could write the faith of Adolf Hitler, truly. I mean, there was a worldview that radically fed his evil mind, and it had a religious, spiritual. I mean, you could write 1,000 pages easy on the faith of Adolf Hitler. Obviously, it's not talking about the evangelical born again status of Adolf Hitler. You could do the same thing on just about anybody, except for the person who just is bland in their religious sentiments or their worldview. I actually thought a few years ago wanted to write basically the faith of a spiritual biography of Axl Rose, the lead singer for Guns N' Roses. And the reason why is because he grew up in a Pentecostal home in southern Indiana. I mean, we're talking the bastion of conservative politics and basically conservative lifestyle, and left home at about 17 or 18, went to L.A. and formed Guns N' Roses, which was just this blast of hedonism during the 80s. And how do you grow up the pastor's kid of a Pentecostal home and then basically become Axl Rose, you know? So I really wanted to write it and reached out to the people that maybe get me in contact with them. And they're like, yeah, I don't think you'd be interested in giving any material on that one. So if you can imagine how you could pull off a book like that, then, you know, Donald Trump or other people, let alone the more saintly people, it's easy. You basically just go with the facts. You try to find the facts and tell the story and resist the urge to make something out of somebody that they're not actually, that doesn't actually describe who they are. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, it totally does, because my connecting point, which I'm going to come back to after a break, is how do we put this all together? Like, how do we live our faith in public in such a way that there would be evidence, there'd be enough evidence to write a 300-page book about, you know, the houses we grew up in and the faith of those people and how it was either transmitted or not transmitted, and then how we are passing that on to the next generation.
Yeah. Just a couple years ago, somebody wrote, I've named the author, escapes me, but wrote The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, right? And who died, he's saying, I'm not a Christian. You know, don't ever let anybody say that on my deathbed I converted to Christ. I didn't, you know. And that book was well received, maybe not by everybody, but it was well received as being a thoughtful, okay, well, what was the spiritual life of this man who spent his entire life, adult life, you know, claiming to be an atheist, you know? So, Stephen Hawking, you could write a book about his religious and spiritual and worldview background, and you know, as long as you had access to the files and his thoughts.
Absolutely.
And things like that. So it'd be fascinating.
Hey, Scott Lamb, thank you. We look forward to the next spiritual biography that you're working on, but we really appreciate this one, The Faith of Donald J. Trump. Thank you for your time today. Friends, I got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll make the connecting point. What does it mean to live our faith in public in such a way, you know, that our legacy would speak for itself? I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. That song is really our conversation point and our connecting point here in terms of the conversations that we're having today. We're taking the headlines of the day. We're talking about what people are talking about, and we are seeking to then come to a place where we can talk with each other about, all right, where is the Christian worldview in all of this? Where is the gospel approach to all of this? I actually heard this Steve Green song, Find Us Faithful, at least for the first time in my memory, at my grandmother's funeral. My cousin Matt sang it, and I was, I was really moved by it. As he sang these words, they rang true of my grandmother's life. She was indeed faithful, full of faith in every way. She is a person who transmitted the gospel generation to generation. When this song says, may all who come behind us find us faithful, it's a good legacy question for each of us to be asking today. It's a good legacy question for us to be asking, you know, on this side of the death of Stephen Hawking. It's a good legacy question for us to be asking in terms of the kinds of conversations we're going to be having with teenagers and families in response to and following this national walkout that happened today in high schools across America. And it's a good conversation for us to have when we talk about the legacy of people who are in positions of political leadership, like our president, who do not appear to have the fruit of the Christian life in many ways. For those of you who listen consistently or listen frequently, you happen to know that I am not a person who believes that we see in the fruitfulness of the language or in the life of the president particular evidence of a vibrant Christian faith. However, we have a person who on whose behalf others testify that, you know, he has recently, I don't know how recently, but I'll use the term recently, within the last few years, come to an understanding that the reception of the grace of God in Jesus Christ is actually essential part of becoming a Christian. And so what does that look like in the infantile stage? Maybe that's what we see, is an infantile variety of Christianity, a late in life come to Jesus. And so that's the conversation I'd love to have with you. If you are open to having that conversation on the phone, that'd be great. The number is 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Already hearing from some folks that, you know, frankly, they're surprised we're having this conversation. If sometimes when I'm talking to someone, it sounds like I am supporting their ideas. Let's listen. Let's see if we can listen. to one another in such a way that is gracious to those whose viewpoint is different than our own. And I am not always going to have conversation partners with whose work I agree. I'm not going to always have conversation partner with whose viewpoints I agree. So one of the things we're trying to demonstrate is how do we actually have civil conversations about things about which we may disagree? And how do we allow people to, you know, share their viewpoint? And how do we listen well enough to recognize that sometimes people are not defending what we suspect they're defending? And so, I just offer that up to you in terms of this conversation today. Let's see. On the walkouts, I have a message here from a listener who is 73 years old. She doesn't understand this whole idea of a walkout. She says that her parents would never have allowed her to walk out. And she was expected to, quote, do the right thing. And she wonders if parents are responsible for some of what happens today by allowing these demonstrations. I appreciate that that view, Sherry. I was trying to imagine if anything that happened when I was in high school rose to the level of, you know, of something that I would have been compelled to walk out of class to make some sort of political statement, either for or against. And I'll just admit to you, I don't know that in high school I necessarily thought that way. And so I'm with you. I was, I was one of the good kids who pretty much did what was right. But I can also tell you that if I had felt compelled, I probably, would have talked with my parents about it. And if it really was an organized thing that, you know, that frankly, these school districts have mostly agreed to allow these students to do this. In many of these situations, the schools provided sort of a safety net around these kids as they took part in these demonstrations. And then in some places, they just didn't have school today, sort of to provide the opportunity for students to participate in this national event. It was going to happen anyway. It's apparently there's going to be another one. This one won't be a school walkout, but a nationwide demonstration related to this on the 24th of March, actually a march in Washington related to this. So I don't think that this conversation is going away. I do think that at least to this point, the demonstrations have all been peaceful. And certainly we want the next generation of Americans to understand what peaceful protest looks like. That's not a bad thing. And so if we can cultivate an ability within our culture to communicate with one another in ways that are peaceful, even if somewhat disruptive in terms of the schedule of the day for schools, then, you know, we certainly we recognize the right of teachers to go on strike from time to time. And so we're recognizing the right, I think, of students to step forward and say, hey, we're not old enough to vote yet, but we want to let you know we don't feel safe in our schools. And we want our political leaders to take some action related to this. You will not hear me talking about gun control. You will hear me talking about school safety, and you will hear me talking about how it is that we can be law-abiding people within the parameters of the rights that we have as Americans. And then you're also going to hear me talk about, you know, what it means to be people who are given rights by God. And so what does it look like to be people who live with the fullness of our responsibility as people who have inalienable rights, and the first of those being life. And so how are we going to be life advocates on all of these issues in the conversations that we're having today? All right, friends, it is a matter of legacy. My legacy, your legacy, the legacy of people like the president, the legacy of people like Stephen Hawking. It's an opportunity for you to enter into the conversation of the day and talk about, when people come behind us, will they find us faithful? What does faithfulness look like? All right, friends, last week we had Chelsea Sobolik on the show about her book, Longing for Motherhood. We now have copies of that to give away. And so if you want to email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com, we will we'll put folks' name in a drawing, and we'll send those books out to you. So if you want a copy of Longing for Motherhood, send me an email, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. All right, friends, you can share today's show with someone else using the Faith Radio app or always at myfaithradio.com. Thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.